I'm still Valerie Ziegler Morris, and this is a session on church and state in the Middle Ages. If I could, I think most everybody has been here before. Let's just review the two positions that we have looked at the last time. Remember, we talked about Christ against culture and Christ of culture. Can somebody take a shot at describing what Christ against? Who believed it, and what did they believe? Barbara, you're smiling.
So. No, I'm not saying anything. I'm here to listen, not to.
No, not at Holden. Yeah.
My husband told me to sit in the second row.
I wouldn't have let you stay, so.
Well, they were antagonistic or opposed to the cultural.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Obviously from the title.
Right.
First century Christians were.
That's right.
And the pagans or the Romans were obviously aware of that because they continuously got persecuted. So maybe not all over the empire at one time. There was always some part of the empire that was going through persecution.
Good. And we talked about Origen saying that Christians were a nation within a nation, an army of piety, and they wouldn't be in the government and wouldn't be in the real army.
That's subversive.
Well, he said it wasn't.
Yes, but
because
I think the government looks at it that way.
Yeah, the government did, and really still does.
The Mennonites ran in the same trouble later centuries. And the Jehovah's Witnesses ran in the same trouble in our country, you know. It was felt to be subversive.
And I think from what you were saying about the situation in Namibia this morning, that maybe the church has been put into a Christ against culture position because the state is so unjust and violent.
If you would call the state and its government the culture, yes, yeah. that would be right.
Okay. And then the other position we looked at was Christ of culture. And that comes about after Constantine becomes a Christian, makes Christianity the religion of the empire. And then all of a sudden, people are happy to serve in government. They don't really find it inconsistent even to be in the army. It seems like a miracle that God, in converting the world to Christianity, has converted the greatest government in the world to Christianity. And so instead of feeling uncomfortable about working with the government, Christians feel called to work with the government. But even then, there's still some Christians that feel like that cultural kind of Christianity isn't radical enough for them. And those are the people who become monks and nuns. They still want to have that heroic kind of Christianity, a kind of Christianity more rigorous than just being baptized and growing up in the faith. All right. How many people did Bible study today? I mean, it's neither good nor bad that you attended. Just okay.
You attended the Bible study this morning?
Yeah. Okay. And you talked about Garden of Eden, right?
Right.
Okay. Let me ask you a question. All right. If Adam and Eve had continued to live in the Garden of Eden and had never gotten kicked out, but they just started having kids and kids and kids, and then their kids had kids, and all of a sudden there were hundreds and then thousands of people living in Eden, would they have had a government? Okay, the creation isn't fallen. Everybody, I guess, is going around naked but not ashamed. Would they have had a government? You think so?
I would think they'd have to have some kind of a system to rule over the people. I mean, somebody has to be in charge. So I get on Earth, God is ultimately in charge there. But even if it was paradise in Eden all the time with all those people there, you have to have something to organize out of what could be. I mean, people just, I don't know.
Yeah.
I think just the opposite.
Because
that's what she wants.
Because first of all, she said they haven't fallen. Therefore, you wouldn't have to have anybody organize it because people would be very thoughtful of each other. People would be able to sense what other people needed, and there wouldn't have to be stop and go lights because you would automatically stop for somebody and say after you. It's hard for me to conceive.
Yeah, there might not have been shopping malls then, so the traffic wouldn't have been so bad.
It's hard for me to conceive of the need for government if we weren't human, meaning fallen. If we aren't fallen, then we need government because we're self-centered.
But we all have such different personalities that eventually I would think, you know, I mean, even up here, this is supposed to be paradise, but this place wouldn't run without rules and regulations.
Oh yeah, but we've fallen plenty. It's hard to conceive.
That's easy for you to say.
I think they started an afternoon argument about whether God said this or God said that or whether we were to understand it this way or that way. So there'd probably be some healthy dialogue, which would probably lead to some stronger opinions, and we'd probably have to have some sort of arbitrator.
We have to have some.
And that's the beginning of government.
All right, so well, does anybody agree with Pat? Is she entirely by herself? No fall,
yeah.
No government?
I'm always by myself, I can see that.
Well, I just want to know who'd build the roads.
Well, they have paths. You wear the roads down by walking on them, and just like they do in some of the, what we call...
Yeah, cows do it. Why can't people?
Yeah, they would just... how far along do we go with this? I mean, are you thinking that it would be...
Well, she has a reason for asking
the question. I'm bringing it forward to the 20th century.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
We're still in Eden, boy. Who's going to build the roads now? Sorry.
No, I mean, I guess Eden is a state of mind. However you want to imagine it is fine with me.
It is tough to imagine it without the fall, though, because then we never it didn't happen that way. But I still think that government would have been necessary, even in a utopia.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I tend to agree with Patty. I think you'd probably have to have some kind of, I don't like to use the word rules, some kind of way of operating in harmony, but the point would be that everyone would be totally cooperative, and you wouldn't have to have penalties,
mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
And God would be the ruler. I mean, they'd talk to him, and he would tell us.
Yeah, sort of spontaneous obedience.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to answer a question from what I said. I think I remember history. In the Babylonia, the area in the Euphrates and so forth, that area, they settled into farmers and agrarian community and somewhat separated from each other, so they weren't running into each other too much, but nothing really progressed there until they got some kind of civil government and began diking the rivers and the floodplains so that then they were able to have cities. Mm-hmm. But it was a unified action. It needed a lot of people cooperating, the engineering and diking to stop the floodplains and so forth. And then their agriculture really grew. And of course, then they just start building these nice little things, temples up to God that they could climb to too. You know?
See, they wouldn't have done that.
But the civil projects never happened until they started to mm-hmm. organize themselves into government.
Makes sense.
Yeah, but they were fallen people.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I mean, it will come as no surprise to you that theologians do not agree on this issue.
It's an issue.
Yes, actually it is an issue.
Probably was an issue in the ages, for sure.
And it's still very much an issue for those of you who are Lutheran. All Lutheran thinking about the role of government starts with this basic question. But I won't tell you till tomorrow what the Lutheran answer is. Oh, I know, no one will sleep tonight, yeah. be still my heart. Let's talk a little bit about Augustine, because he and Aquinas don't agree on this issue. Now, Augustine, you know, was a bishop in North Africa and a famous preacher and writer, even in his own day. And while he was alive in 410, Rome was sacked and by the barbarians, which really are most of our ancestors. So we probably don't really call them barbarians, but Augustine did. And people began to say, why? Why has this happened to Rome now? We've been such a great empire for so long. And a lot of people said, well, the reason this has happened is because Rome went Christian. And we just, Rome lost what it took to be an empire. The Christians made us soft and lazy and stupid. And Augustine wrote a book called The City of God, in which he tried to defend the Christians and say that it wasn't really the Christians' fault that Rome had fallen. And in order to do that, he had to talk about the fall and what sin was. And now, how many of you know the story of Augustine's life? You don't? Yeah, I mean, most people, well, if you go to divinity school, you almost have to read something of the Confessions. And lots of times they might make you do it in literature class in college, if you're unlucky. Basically, Augustine grew up in sort of a middle-class family in North Africa, and his parents sent him away to boarding school. His father then lost his job when Augustine was about 16, and the family ran out of money. And Augustine had to come home and live at home for a year while the family saved up enough money for Augustine to go back to boarding school. And in his year off of school, he sort of just hung out with his friends. And they didn't, you know, they couldn't like cruise Main Street back then and go to McDonald's. So they cruised as best they could. And an event happened that year that really shaped Augustine's view of the world. And it's sort of innocuous. His friends went out one night to a farmer's orchard and stole some pears. And the pears weren't even ripe. They were green. And Augustine said, you know, I don't even like pears. And particularly, I don't much like green pears. But I loved stealing the pears. And if anything gave them flavor and sweetness, it was the sin that compelled me to steal them. And from that, Augustine began thinking about what it means to be a person who loves to sin. Because the Platonic philosophers had sort of argued that people sin because they get confused. Like, everybody wants to do the good, it's just that we have trouble figuring out what the good is. But Augustine said, people sin because they really like it. It's like those pears. You know, you sneak out at night, you steal the pears, the farmer gets mad. I mean, it's really great. You know, sort of like, I don't know what kids do at Halloween today, that kind of stuff, messing up people's houses. Augustine said, that's really what sin is. And he became convinced that that's really what people were, that they were beings that enjoyed sin. Now, Augustine's mother was really, really overbearing. And she and her friend used to get together for Bible study all the time. And they would pray that...
When's the city?
1900? Yeah, exactly. Some things never change. In Bible study, they would pray for Augustine's conversion. And so Augustine was pretty sure that whatever happened to him in his life, he would not be a Christian, because he didn't want to spend the rest of his days going to Bible study with people like his mother's friends. So eventually... Yeah, actually, the Confessions are a remarkably modern work. Eventually, he just moved out of North Africa. He went to Milan in Italy. And he fell in with a group of sophisticated, urbane Christians. which surprised him because he never knew there could be any. And in particular, he was really impressed with the bishop in Milan, a guy named Ambrose, who gave very educated, eloquent sermons. And Augustine had never really heard anything like that, especially coming out of his mom's Bible study. And he began to be sort of drawn to the group. In the meantime, he was having big time problems in his sexual life. He had brought his mistress from Africa with him when he moved to Italy. And she and he had a son named Adeodatus, which is proof that you should not have been born in the Middle Ages, or they would name you something weird like that. And Augustine's mother, Monica, sneaked over on a boat and said, you know, if you want to get ahead in life, which he did very much, he was real career oriented, you need to dump this woman and marry somebody appropriate for your station. And Augustine was convinced that maybe that was a good idea. So he shipped his mistress and his kid back to Africa and got engaged to a nice girl. Of appropriate social station. Yeah, this is sort of Augustine as a yuppie.
Yeah.
All right. The problem with this nice girl of appropriate social station was he didn't really like her and wasn't sexually attracted to her. So eventually, after some agony, he dumped her, just called off the engagement. But then he was stuck. The person he really loved and his son were in Africa. The person he was engaged to, he had just called that off. There he was in Milan by himself. What was he going to do? Well, the only logical thing was he found somebody else to live with. So he moved in with somebody else. It was about this time that he began to realize that he wasn't really in control of that side of his life at all. That when he had gone out to steal the pears and knowingly committed and loved committing evil, that had been fun and he had chosen to do it. But this side of his life, using, enjoying, abusing in some way people, he wasn't in control of that at all. It's also around this time that a friend of his told him the story of Antony. We talked about Antony last time, the great monk who went to the desert, lived a really heroic, ascetical life, only ate once a week, all that kind of stuff. And Augustine said, you know, being a Christian like my mother is really disgusting to me, but being a Christian like Antony is really compelling to me. And I think that I could pull my life together if I could begin to live like that. And in fact, I think that I will begin to live like that. The only problem was only part of Augustine really wanted to live like that. The rest of Augustine was saying, are you crazy? Live in the desert, no food, no sex, no friends. This is impossible. This is inconceivable, and we ain't doing it. And so he went into a time of great inner turmoil. He said it was like having two selves, and one self wanted one thing, and the other self wanted another, and he just couldn't resolve it. And so finally, in his famous conversion scene, he's out in a garden with his friend Alypius, and he's so upset that he throws himself on the ground, and he's weeping and wailing, and he knows he's never ever going to commit his life to Christ. And he hears a child out in the alley singing, pick it up and read, pick it up and read. And he figures, well, why not? So he does what everybody secretly wants to do with their Bible. He grabs it, you know, opens it, does this number, and reads it. And lo and behold, it's a passage that seems to be given to him, because the passage says, not in rioting and wantonness, not in drunkenness and loose living, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ. And at that moment, Augustine said, I could not convert myself "O Christ, but you converted me." And from that moment on, he dramatically changed his life. He gave up mistresses, gave up sex, became a respectable Christian, and eventually became a bishop. But what really stuck in Augustine's mind was this idea that he couldn't make himself believe. It was only when God converted him that he was able to believe. I don't know if that coincides with your own experience of faith or not. I think especially in modern times, we tend to think a lot about making our own choices and deciding to become Christian or whatever. But Augustine was convinced that nobody could really make that decision. All right, so you're thinking, well, okay, but how does that relate to what Augustine thought about the state? Okay. This is how it relates. Augustine said, you know, it occurs to me that sin is really, really radical. That we are messed up in a way that is profound. That most people, in fact, all people, unless God converts them, all people love themselves or an extension of themselves, be it their job, their family, their country, whatever. All of us tend to love ourselves rather than God. And it's only the person whom God converts that can ever go from loving self to loving God. And so he said, everybody is divided by that original love. What is it that you most love profoundly? Yourself or God? Okay? And he said, you know I live in a Christian society, but I know that just because we say everyone in this society is Christian, I know that all of us don't really love God to the exclusion of self. And so some of us in the church are really living in what he called the city of God, that city that loves God to the exclusion of the self. And the rest of us are living in the city of earth, that city that loves the self or loves the government. And he said, now it's really hard to distinguish the two. You can't just, you know, look and say, well, Pat, city of earth, Stan, city of God. You can't do it that easily. But instead of saying that, like Origen said, the church is a nation within a nation, Augustine said, well, we know that church and culture are intermingled. You can't have one without the other, at least not if you live in Rome. But within this Christian culture, there are those who belong to the invisible church, the city of God, and then there's everybody else. All right? Now, if people are radically fallen, Augustine said, and he thought they were, he said, you know, I think that God institutes government in order to try to control our sin. So Pat, you're sort of an Augustinian. Augustine says, if people had never fallen, if Eden had just gotten more and more populated, then there never would have been a government. But because people did fall, and fall radically, we have to have a state. And so God institutes the state to, really to coerce people who are evil, to protect the good and punish the wicked. So is the state good or bad, according to Augustine? Take a guess.
Necessary evil.
Okay, yeah, that's exactly what Augustine would say. It's a necessary evil. He'd say, well, you gotta have one, because if you didn't have one, the strong would like eat up the weak. But the state isn't anything like the city of God. Again, in the city of God, people love God. In the city of earth, where the state lives, people love the self. In the city of God, order is created, and it's good. Just like Pat was saying earlier, you know, people have never fallen, Augustine said. They would just like sit around and talk to God. Just like when God's talking to Adam and Eve, and God would tell them what to do, and they would do it, and they wouldn't need an intermediary. But in the city of earth, order is fallen and sinful. By that, Augustine means it's coercive. You know, how do I know you won't run a red light? Well, probably because I know you don't want to pay a traffic ticket.
Or get killed.
Yeah, or get killed. You know, why do we know that people don't buy guns and rob stores continually? Well, because we have police to coerce them into not doing that. And Augustine says, that kind of order is fallen, but it's not totally evil. I mean, it's better to have coerced order than no order, but it's nothing like the good order of the creation. Order in the city of God is maintained by faith. Order in the city of earth is maintained by force. Justice in the city of God is true. You never have a conflict between justice and order in the city of God. In the city of earth, justice is partial and tentative. You do what you can, but most laws don't really equitably treat everyone. Most wars, if you believe in just wars, well, it's a very partial and tentative way of achieving anything. And peace, he says, in the city of God, peace is the peace of concord when hearts are one. Peace in the city of earth, he called the Pax Romana. It's an absence of war maintained by force. It's not the harmony of hearts that are one. It's a coerced order that through threats prevents open violence. Maybe we should stop for a minute and just see what you think about all of that. Augustine's trying to say, you know, the state is good. It's like Pat said, it's a necessary evil, but it exists only because of sin. And true Christians are called to an order and a love that just is far beyond anything the state can begin to achieve. Yeah.
Did he really think that the city of God was attainable, or was he just speaking in a... What shall we say, idealistic way or utopian way?
Well, in the sense of could it ever exist on earth?
Yes.
No, he didn't think that.
Not even in a monastery?
No, not even in a monastery.
Okay.
Because, again, it's only God that calls those people, and it's not their decision, it's God's decision. And... There's nothing anyone can do to build the city of God. It's God's creation.
So the city of God consists of all Christians throughout the world that follow God's will.
Mm-hmm. That love God,
okay,
before they love themselves.
All right, and then like Pax Romana, or the absence of war maintained by force, would be, would he say that the... nuclear situation that we have now between the Soviet Union and the United States, that would be Pax Romana. We're not at war, but it's certainly maintained by...
Yep, uh-huh.
Force.
It's a very good example of it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Augustine is famous for articulating the just war ethic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, we've looked at early Christians who wouldn't be in the army at all to Christians after Constantine, who didn't see really any inconsistency with being in the army. And Augustine and Ambrose as well came up with this just war theory, which was an attempt to limit war. Augustine said, if a nation wants to go to war, there are rules. You should follow just methods in the war. The war should seek morally justifiable goals that it can reasonably hope to attain, losses should be proportionate to the good that you hope to obtain, and it has to be exercised under a legitimate authority. In other words, no revolutions.
Who defines morally justifiable goals? That goes back to God?
Yeah, in a sense. Well, like, one thing that would never be justifiable would be to say, I think I'll just invade and take over your country. A justifiable goal is defense, for example. Aggression, the desire just to get more territory, is never a justifiable goal.
So Israel's situation, where they're surrounded on all sides by enemies, that's justifiable that they at certain times would go to war.
Yeah, I think you could, actually.
Isn't there also something that says that there's a good prospect of winning?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it
has to be winnable. Uh-huh. Of course, you know, a lot of modern writers who are thinking about just war and nuclear war question whether nuclear war or modern war, since it is always in danger of becoming nuclear, can ever be just, because the prospects of winning a nuclear war are virtually nil. I mean, even if you win, you lose, kind of thing. So some people think that just war is, you know, really a wimpy way of not being a pacifist. Like, real Christians should be pacifists, but then some, you know, you get into just war and you're just too wimpy to be a pacifist. Other people say, well, if you really followed the rules of just war, you wouldn't fight very many. Just war isn't as wimpy as it sounds.
What about the wars that were fought for the Jews to invade Judea and Palestine? That was just an invasion, right? That's saying that war wasn't just. Those wars weren't just, and that was God's directing it.
Yeah, according to the canons of just war, those wars were not just. But they do have, or did have, something, at least according to the Old Testament accounts, that no one much is claiming for modern wars of aggression, and that is that God directly spoke to the Jews and told them to do it. So in theory, I suppose, if God ever directly spoke to people again and told them to have a holy war.
So that's another criterion for just war, if God tells you to do it.
Well, Augustine doesn't really talk about that, but people who talk about holy wars usually say that's what made those wars okay. I don't think any of us much trust anybody that says God told us to have a holy war.
Well, God, in Augustine, God wouldn't talk to you and tell you to go to war. God would convert you and have you enter into the city of God, and then you would not need to have a just war, kind of thing. That's the only where God acts in the whole Augustinian scheme. I don't think you'd have a God coming in and going, "Yoo-hoo, Rome," or "Yoo-hoo, North Africa," you know.
Yeah, or in the Old Testament, to preserve Israel as a separate entity to carry the covenant into the world, then the holy war was justified to an evil that they had, that separateness.
Augustine also introduced what ethicists called a graded ethic, when he talked about citizens' obligations to the state. And by that he meant that according to what station you fill, you have a different role to play. For example, if we're wondering, gosh, should we go to war? Augustine would have said, well, the emperor decides that. That's the emperor's job. The soldier's job is to obey and to go to war out of love for the neighbor, because it's a just war. The private citizen's job is to remain non-resistant, just like in the Sermon on the Mount. And in fact, Augustine said, say you're a soldier, you're home from the war on furlough, and you get attacked on the street. All right. At that point, you are not serving as a soldier in the army. You're a private citizen. So you shouldn't even defend yourself.
You shouldn't.
No, that's what the police do. In general, people should obey the Sermon on the Mount. All private citizens should obey it. If you need protection, that's what police are for. Now, if you're called to go to war, that's different. That's just a labor of love that you have to do. In the same way that people in the City of God sort of sadly but necessarily support the state, because without the state, there'd be chaos. So, you know, you do your best for it, but another part of you in your private life is really separate and different from it. Did you?
Well, what would the what would Augustine think of our government today in the United States about a democracy? Because, you know, I see a government ruled by force as something like the Soviet Union has, or you know, some of the other communist bloc countries or other dictatorships, where, I mean, they've got police and soldiers everywhere. I mean, here police are, you know, they're certainly available, and soldiers, we have our soldiers too, but yet it's not, you know, we have certain freedoms that many freedoms in other countries don't. Mm-hmm. And what would he think of our government?
I think Augustine would say, okay, this government may be approaching true justice more than, say, a tyrannical government, but it's still coercive. If you don't think so, don't pay your taxes this year. And then find out if people try to coerce you. See what I mean?
That's a good point, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's still coercive. Mm-hmm. So Augustine's sort of schizophrenic in a way.
How could you have a government, though, that wasn't coercive? I
mean, you can't, because government exists really to control sin. And so government exists to control people who are sinful and really will be radically sinful. So government has to be coercive. But it's still sad, because as a Christian, you'd much rather be non-resistant than coercive. So in your private life, in fact, you will be non-resistant, but as a person working in or supporting the state, you have to support the coercion of the state, because that's the only way the state will work. You know, if taxes were voluntary, who would pay them? Well, yeah.
A few people.
Yeah. That one's pretty clear.
Yes. Not enough, sure.
Another term that people use to talk about Augustine is they say that he has a doctrine, golly, of preservation when he talks about the state. Because the state isn't an order of creation. Wouldn't have existed if there'd never been a fall. God only institutes the state to preserve creation. All right? Pope Gelasius, briefly, was Pope at the end of the 6th century, and he made up a theory that became very famous. It was called the Two Swords Theory. And do you remember the passage in Luke where the disciples are coming up to Jesus and they want to have like a war or something, and Jesus says, well, how many swords do you have? And the disciples say, Lord, we have two swords. And Jesus says, that is enough. Okay, sort of a weird little passage. Gelasius looked at that and he said, well, Jesus there is really talking about how the world is ruled. There are not one sword, but two swords. And he said, what I think is that God, like, looked at the world, and to the church, God gave the sword to rule the spiritual realm. And to the emperor, God gave the sword to rule the temporal realm. The problem with Gelasius's theory was he never said exactly how the two related. He did say that the church had the weightier responsibility. because it was in charge of eternal salvation, whereas the emperor was only in charge of temporal things. But people spent the rest of the Middle Ages sort of trying to duke it out over whose sword was bigger, in a sense. And in fact, in Pope Gregory VII, Pope Gregory VII made up a new version of the two-sword theory, and this is like in the 13th century. He said, no, make it 12th century. He said, well, you know, when you think about it, who's God's representative on earth? Well, that'd be Christ. All right. And Christ isn't on earth anymore, but Christ has left his vicar on earth. And who would that be? Peter. Descended from Peter would be the Pope. And when you think about it, I mean, if God's given all power on earth to his representative, which is the Pope, that means the Pope gets both swords. But because the Pope is really busy and can't really manage everything, the Pope sort of graciously takes one of his swords and gives it to the emperor. But that just shows you that the emperor's sword is really secondary. It's derived from the sword of the church. Well, if you ever want to debate that issue, I don't know, it's a weird one. Let's jump instead to Aquinas, who instead of a doctrine of preservation, wants to argue for a doctrine of creation. All right, and I want to sort of talk about the fall again for a minute. Think about, if we had, we don't have tennis courts here. Okay, think about if you're really hiking, hot, 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 like if the sun ever did come out. And, yeah, and so you made it to Heart Lake and you finally open the water bottles and you're gonna take a drink, but you find that the hike house has left a little note with your water bottles that said, just wanted you to know that we peed in one of them.
Okay. What does this have to do with the fall? I'm waiting for this.
Okay, all right, let's take a vote. How many people want to drink the water out of that water bottle?
You mean if you have no choice of other liquid and you're dying from thirst?
No, just in general, how many people think it's worth drinking?
Nobody.
Okay, yeah, right, nobody. Although, you know, let's just say they peed just a teeny tiny little bit. You couldn't see it, smell it, detect it, but you know it's there. All right, for Augustine, that's sort of what the fall does to the creation. All right.
It isn't its water bottles.
It ruins it. All right. Okay, now I want to discuss someone who doesn't really think that's what the fall is like. Aquinas says, think for a moment about when you come to Holden. Aquinas had great vision and he knew that people would come here. And yes, because he was a Dominican. You sit out on the porch at night and it's not quite dark yet, so you can see the peaks, but the stars are beginning to come out and you can see the snow on top of the mountains. And you know, as surely as you know that you are sitting there, that you're in the presence of a wonderful creation, and that that creation is the product of a loving creator. You can't come to Holden and not know that. Aquinas said, there is an order in our universe that clearly tells us of the glory of God. And everybody has access to that order. He called it natural law. All of us have innately an ability to see God and know God as God is expressed in the universe. The fall, Aquinas said, is a darkening of the mind and a weakening of the will. People inexplicably turned away from the good of creation, and there's no explanation for that. But what they need, he says, is, oh, not to filter the water so that you get the urine out. A dark mind can be enlightened, and a weak will can be strengthened through habit and holy acts. For Aquinas, sin is like someone who's nearsighted, like I am, maybe some of you are too. Without my glasses, I can sort of see, but I can see a lot better with them. For Aquinas, that's what grace does for people. It's not that violent conversion that Augustine talks about. For Aquinas, grace comes to us, and it doesn't, well, he's got this famous saying, grace does not destroy nature, but completes it. All right? So that innate ability that we all have to see God and know God and love God, grace strengthens that, repairs it, and completes it. For Aquinas, institutions are really a natural expression of the creation. Even if we'd never fallen, just like y'all were saying, you know, there would have been just a need to organize. People are just, they're social beings. Everybody doesn't go around with this incredible vertical relationship with God. They also relate with one another. So even if there'd never been a fall, there would still be a creation. Government is an institution of the creation. And also, even though there is a fall, still people can still know God and obey God, even people who aren't Christian. Natural laws for everybody. So being a Christian doesn't necessarily even make a person a better ruler, because everybody can see and know and love God. All right, so what does government do then? Aquinas says, government establishes order and justice. It makes us good citizens, and it prepares us for the greater work that the church does. The church completes the work. If government makes us good citizens, the church makes us good Christians. All right? There are some things that people never could know on their own. You might know that God is creator. You would never know that God is redeemer if someone hadn't told you the story of Jesus. So revelation completes natural knowledge. It adds to it. It completes it, but it never negates it. All right, the way that that sort of comes out in terms of government is you don't need to feel ambiguous about being in government or supporting government, because government's doing what it ought to do. Remember with Augustine, you always feel like, I don't know. I mean, I gotta help it because it's better than nothing. If we didn't have this government, we might have a worse one. But you always feel in addition that what you're being called to do as a citizen isn't really as holy, isn't really as obedient to the Sermon on the Mount as what you are as a Christian. Aquinas says, no, that's not true at all. Government is just, it's a part of God's creation. You shouldn't feel ambiguous about it. I mean, it's different from the church, yeah. You know, the church is dealing out salvation. The government's dealing out highways. But the two don't conflict with each other. Not if government is good. I mean, if government's unjust, tyrannical, if people are refusing to obey natural law, then it's a bad government. But that's people's fault, individuals' fault. On the whole, there's no reason why government can't do what it's supposed to do. Create order, some justice, make people ready to receive and hear the gospel. So, you know, don't feel bad about being a citizen or being in government. You don't need to feel bad. it's consistent with being a Christian.
What do you think about the when Paul says that we're supposed to pray for the government, pray for our leaders, what would he think about that then? I would think the two would have differing opinions, Aquinas and Augustine, or would the, what's your opinion?
Yeah, they would both say you should pray for the government. But Aquinas would say, well, of course you should pray for the government. You know, government is fine. You shouldn't worry about being a part of it any more than you worry about, you know, wearing clothing. You know, is wearing clothing something that's inconsistent with being a Christian? No. I mean, it just, it keeps you warm so you can really be a Christian. They'd both pray for the government, but Aquinas would do so happily, and Augustine would do so sadly, I think. Because Augustine's sad that there is a government. And Aquinas says, you know, what's the problem? You know, the government isn't the church, and they don't do the same things, but what they do complements each other, as long as the government is just. Now, a government that's out of control, that doesn't understand that first the church gets both swords, and that government is to respect the church, that's a bad government, and that's something different. But I mean, I don't think, for example, Aquinas would be upset by our government. He might not like specific things that we do, but he would not feel uncomfortable with being an American and a Christian.
Even at all, the expression of separation of church and state.
Actually, Aquinas probably wouldn't be that hot on separating church and state. Because he does think that the state exists to serve the church. But for this time and this place, you know, it's sort of the way that people do things. As long as the government obeys natural law, it's doing fine. That's all we expect it to do. We don't expect it to do more. You know, it's like sending kids off to first grade. We don't really think they'll do calculus. You know, as long as they just learn some math, like first graders do, then that's fine. They're building the basis that will later let them do calculus. Government gives us an order that reflects God's order in some way. Some governments do it better than others. And then you don't worry about it beyond that. The church will take care of things. It's the church that deals in salvation, not the government. How many people feel comfortable with that?
With Aquinas' opinion?
Uh-huh. Yeah. That position gets called the Christ above culture.
Yeah.
And you can sort of think of it, well, the way I do, as a, I know this will really help you. This is a pyramid. And I sort of think of it as like, you know, this is culture and government. And then you need church or revelation, if you want to call it that, to top it off. And you're not really complete without the top part, but the two don't conflict. You know, you gotta have a culture, and there's no need to feel bad about it. And okay, you know, this part doesn't get to be the point, and the point's the best because it's on top. But, you know, you gotta have the bottom part too.
Is the Augustinian view also of Christ above culture kind of model, or sort of a depressed Christ above culture model?
The way I have described Augustine, and here if you do go read Niebuhr's Christ and Culture, you'll find that he and I are disagreeing. I'm describing Augustine as Christ and Culture in paradox.
Huh.
Niebuhr should have loved that.
He thought Augustine was a Calvinist. And I'm describing him in a different manner. But Yeah, that I, you know, that the two go together, but you're never comfortable being in both of them. You have to be, but there's something paradoxical about the whole thing. You know, it's just, it's weird to be fighting in the army and killing people as fast as you can and then coming home and not even defending yourself if somebody attacks you on the street. That seems sort of paradoxical. But Augustine says that's the way we got to do it.
But in Augustine's time, there was not any democracies, or there were not any democracies.
Yeah, no, not really.
Yeah.
That didn't really bother Augustine that much. I mean, people weren't into democracy back then.
So that wouldn't have tainted his view, though. I mean, I think it would have, because if that's all he would have known, would be the government of the Roman Empire or monarchies, which is possibly what was around then. To me, that's one person telling everybody else what to do.
Yeah, but what's the difference? Whether one fallen man is running the thing, or a majority of fallen men are running the thing. They're all fallen.
Yeah. Plus, I mean, Augustine just doesn't have our modern bias that democracy is better. And in fact, it's interesting. There are still a lot of Christians who don't really have that bias. I've been doing some work on Southern Baptist theology, and equality is not a good metaphor for them. Hierarchy is a good metaphor. They really prefer hierarchy, at least when you're talking about people relating to God and also people in the church relating to each other. They like hierarchy. Yeah.
What about the idea of consensus versus majority against the minority? I mean, that smacks a little bit of a difference, a different attitude towards government. But I mean, what about the Quaker idea of consensus?
Oh my goodness! Well, that's
over
radical.
Against the other idea of what you call democratic government.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was going to say is I find it hard to separate Christ and government. I mean, and I think that's our problem. We have separated Christ and government, and our governments don't want run with God at the helm.
Mm-hmm.
They run with selfishness at the helm, and that's our trouble.
Well, I think that is a good note to end on, because Pat has now declared herself to be a closet Calvinist.
Yeah.
And